Apologies for last week. That's a thing that happened. Let me turn the gain down a little bit. Apologies for last week. That's not me resetting, by the way. No, because that, I don't want you to think that you heard an editing error or a continuity error, because if you've listened to this, you know there is no editing. There's not even there would need to be editing for it to be an editing continuity error, for there to be things to cut off. No, I press play, and then things start rolling. Things start moving right along, to quote The Muppet Show. Not The Muppet Show, The Muppet Movie. The song from... I was going to say the song from The Muppet Movie, and then the S turned into show, and then... Yeah, see, look, this is how we're starting. But again, apologies for last week. Last week, there was not a thing. And yeah, I actually recorded a thing, and then... I recorded a thing, and then ended up getting combination distracted by a thing, so the recording went haywire and bad, and I started doing a dumb joke, but then decided not to finish the dumb joke, and it just ended up being a short, not very good thing that I just did not feel comfortable releasing out to the world, and at that point I did not really also feel like redoing it, so we just missed a week. That's just how things go. I see, I told myself that I was also going to do some sort of reset at the start of this, attempt to be something semi-professional, quote-unquote, whatever. I mean, yes, I know that the complete lack of professionality is part of its charm, but, speaking of charm, I was told this week on two separate occasions at work during meetings that I have a quote-unquote radio voice, which is very exciting. I appreciate that. I enjoy hearing those things because, spoiler alert, I enjoy podcasts. I do one, so. But, again, like I said, in the era of professionalism and radio and podcasts and all that good stuff, this is the Profundity Podcast. It's a show that I say words on. My name's Andrew Whipple, and I talk for between half an hour in an hour, or less than half an hour, sometimes 20 minutes. Sometimes, as was the case of last week, 10 minutes, but that 10 minutes never got released, so no minutes. So I guess this is episode 23 then. Yeah, cool. But this is a show where I say words, and that's about it. It's kind of a diary show. It's more of a ramble show than a diary show, sort of loosely modeled off your I Seem Funds and your The Smartest Man in the Worlds. Very loosely, because I don't actually... See, here's the dirty secret. I don't listen to monologue podcasts. I don't really... I like the monologues at the beginning of, like, WTF or Kinda Neat or shows like that that start off with monologues. I'm actually okay with those, but for some reason, I don't really ever listen to monologue, long-form monologue podcasts, which, you know, is weird that then that's what I decided to do. I mean, it makes sense that this is why I decided to do this, because... A, I think that I'm a person that is moderately entertaining when I'm talking off the cuff, and B, like I've said many times, the whole purpose of this more than anything is practicing being comfortable on microphone, practicing being able to generate content, putting myself in a situation where I have to generate content on a weekly basis, and yeah, like I said, the point of this is much more practice and much more improving my skills, or improving, potentially. See, good starts saying words. Isn't this all lovely? Anyway, this week there actually is a thing that must be discussed. Unlike this is going to be a bit of a throwback to an episode a few months ago, wherein the entire thing was discussing one thing, and that one thing was something that had to do with pop music. And the reason why is because, oh my goodness gracious, ladies and gentlemen, I went to the Taylor Swift 1989 tour concert on Saturday here in sunny Santa Clara, California. I don't live in Santa Clara, but I live very near Santa Clara. That was the closest concert to me, and it was great. So I got my ticket on Friday night, actually, because I was, I don't know, they were expensive, and I don't like the idea of spending money, and yes, I may have been making enough money this summer that it's perfectly okay, and also, like, the combination of making money and also very not spending money. I've spent almost nothing this summer, barring rent and food, and the monitor for my computer but I got it on sale, and it's been the thing that I've been wanting to get for a really long time, so whatever. But I don't spend very much money, and so then, A, that made me feel weird about spending this, but it should also make me feel okay about spending all this money on this concert ticket, because I could afford to, because I don't spend money normally. But, you know, old habits and such. But I'm going to just say but a lot, and that's just how this is going to go. It's going to be very prurient and PG-13, because we'll talk about butts a lot, but not the actual whatever. So I got the ticket, and I did luck out, though. I got pretty good seats. for the ticket price. I got the ticket that I got was, it was one single seat. It was about $100 cheaper than all the other seats in that area, in that it was being sold at face value, as opposed to being ridiculously overinflated. So that was great. And the seats were wonderful. They were right center in the back. They were in the first section of seats off the floor. There were three sections of off the floor seats, and I was in the first of them, and like 20 rows back in that seat, in that first section. So great, lovely, far away, yeah, but perfectly lovely seats. And yeah, being center, even though yes, center was further away than if I was on the side, it gives a better like overall view of the show, which is great because the show was beautifully set up as a. So I tend to prefer smaller either. I tend to prefer indoor shows. I tend to prefer small club shows to outdoor shows, which is what this was, because it was an outdoor stadium, and stadium shows, generally speaking, because there's something about that intimacy, and also because the bands that I like tend to play in those settings, but mostly that intimacy, that idea of, like, you're overwhelmed by the sheer loudness of the music because you're so in a small, enclosed space with blaringly loud stuff happening, which, of course, is bad for ears and bad for me, having a parent who is a ear, nose, and throat doctor, so, it's my youthful teenage rebellion, I say, as a 21-year-old. But I tend to like those more than arena shows, but I'm also never the kind of person that's like, they're, you know, arena shows suck, because I have gone to a lot of arena shows, and I do really enjoy them, but they're very much a different type of musical concert-going experience. But again, generally speaking, the indoor show in the small venue is preferable. That all being said, this is far and away the best arena show I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen some pretty good arena shows. Bruce Springsteen was great when I saw him in 2008, I think. Bruce Springsteen was great. U2 was great. Van Halen was fun. AC/DC was fun. You're noticing a time period theme, I suppose. All American Rejects were great. To break from the classic rock. Ooh, that got really loud because I got really close to the microphone. Maybe I'll just talk right here the whole time. Maybe I'll just derail. This is the very NPR thing, minus the big plosive. Sorry about that. Okay. Anyway, back we are. Then hopefully when it's in mono, you won't have to deal with this weird stereo switching that's happening as I go back and forth from side to side. Anyway, that was great. It was definitely a show that was designed to work in an arena. Which is sort of in the same way that like U2 did, is that they very much built an arena show that is meant to work in this giant environment that they can play to it, that takes advantage of it, that is larger than life in a way that an indoor, simple concert cannot be. And which is not not necessarily a requirement. Bruce Springsteen manages to make a big, larger-than-life arena show simply by virtue of the fact that, as a performer, has such an electric presence that it will fill whatever space he's in. He doesn't do any fancy video screens, or at least when I saw him, didn't do any fancy video screens or fancy lighting effects, stuff like that, but it's just the size of the band and the electricity and the size of the music they're playing can fill an entire arena. Now, Taylor can also do that. Her music is great, and her music can expand to fill the space. But she also designed a beautiful, gorgeous, incredible show. It was a show with an arc. It was a show with movements. It was a show with, I will say, and part of this is I was far back, and so who knows how it would look up close like it would be. But if I were ever producing a Broadway show, the first people that I would interview to do lighting and production effects, especially, and video effects, would be the team on the 1989 tour, because they were incredible. The use of, on a static screen, employing depth and simulating depth, especially in the scenes, because a lot of the, you know, this album on the whole is incredibly influenced by Taylor Swift moving to New York, in perhaps very over the top and oblique ways, like in Welcome to New York, which still don't like that song. It's just so on the nose. It feels very juvenile. It feels very, like, a very simplistic way of getting at this idea that, like, yes, New York influences you, but it very much, I don't know, it sort of strikes me as that. It's what a New Yorker who just moved to New York, which is would write about it, which is, yes, a very valid perspective to have, the like brand new and still swept up in the, don't get me wrong, I love New York in only the times that I've visited, or from the perspectives that I've gotten from the people that live there. So this is not me being like a New York basher. This is a fact. If anything, it's like there's an acknowledgement of the grime that is missing from a song like Welcome to New York, which is again okay, because not every song has to be a complete picture of the topic that it's trying to discuss, but it feels very first. Lyrically, it feels very first draft. It feels very like, all right, we got this idea, let's punch it up a little bit. Especially in comparison to other much more clever or interesting, or even, you know, gets at the point in, it just gets at the point in such a blunt way, as opposed to using any sort of nuance and sort of sneaking up on the point the way that a song like Blank Space does, I think. The album is very influenced by New York, even if it's not in the most, even ignoring the incredibly on-the-nose songs that are literally about moving to New York, like Welcome to New York. So a lot of the songs would have New York backdrops and or incorporate New York in some way into their scenery and into their... So the way that it was set up is there were actual pieces of scenery that would come on for various songs, but by and large the scenery was made up of a giant screen in the back that would have video effects on it, which is good. That's a very economical way to do it. You can set up everything and then make it not have to actually build and deal with. You can just run the video. That's great. Hooray. Whew. Okay. Running out of breath. Yikesity yikes yikes yikes. So you can do that. And so it's a very economical way, especially for a touring show. Great. Good call. But it made for very interesting things. Especially when there would be rain, there was a lot of water imagery and a lot of rain imagery, which I think makes sense. Because you have all sorts of songs that discuss rain in various ways. Clean certainly, is all about rain. How You Get the Girl deals with it. There's this idea of like things washing away. So visually speaking, that metaphor and not image, a kind of icon, kind of iconography. There's a word for like a visual theme that keeps reappearing many times over the course of a text. I'm so upset with myself right now for not being able to think of what this word is. But there's a word for it. It's used in English class. Motif. The motif of rain. The motif of rainwater coming down and cleansing rainwater. Which is interesting. Then you also compare with things like wine stained dress. So how other liquids can ruin. So water that falls and ruins, and water that falls and cleans. Whatever. Anyway. Neither here nor there. Of course, what do you mean? What do I mean, neither here nor there? This is an entire hour long that I'm going to be talking about going to a Taylor Swift concert, so anything is fair game. Maybe I'll get to that later. Why I say neither here nor there is because I'm thinking of that. I made that realization only just now, so I haven't fully formed it out, and blah, 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 whatever. So, the 3D effects that were in use with the rainwater on the one plane and then the stuff, the buildings and streets and stuff going on behind, incredible, worked really well, at least from far away. I don't know how well it looked up close, so this would be when I say, you know, the first thing I would do would hire these people. Who knows, maybe I'm sure it's a different skill designing for a large arena tour and designing for a theatrical show, but I gotta say it just looked really good. And I've never seen a theatrical show that used projection, which is all the rage right now for good reason, because it's cheaper than having to deal with, especially if you just own the projectors in-house at the theater. There's a big upfront cost, but it's cheaper than having to deal with sets, and you can theoretically do cooler things. But I've never seen a play that used projection heavily where it universally worked. It'll work in moments, but there always will be at least one moment where the production just completely falls flat, and it's just like, oh, so fake-looking, or distracting, or things like that. Now, of course, the issue of distraction in a giant, high-voltage bright, flashy concert, you get rid of. Especially because you also don't have to worry about the issue of realism. It's all symbolic. It's all iconography. It's, you know, this is a concert that has backup dances and stuff like that. You're removing any premise. Like, yes, you also have the musicians up there as well, but you're removing this premise of, like, oh, it's just simply playing the music and nothing else. There is sort of a level of performance and artificiality thrown into that, which is okay. I'm fine with that. It's a good thing. So again, who knows whether that would work in a theatrical setting, because in theatrical setting, yes, you can still have artifice and you can still have symbolism. But generally speak, and actually, you know, more so than in a film, you want theater can sort of thrive on that symbolism. You know, you have your fact that back in the day, Shakespeare plays didn't have sets. And so, or very many props. And it would just be the language would tell you, hey, I'm here now. And that's, you would fill it in yourself. So, you know, maybe that could work. But I think the problem with most theatrical productions is they try to go for realism. And instead of living in a symbolic world, they go for realism and then they can't achieve it. And then that is unpleasant. So whatever. Okay. The coolest bit when it came in terms of visuals and projections, by a long shot. I mean, lots of the show was great, but how you get the girl, actually, because for that, everyone was dressed in Taylor Swift to a two-piece skirt and top combo that was looked all just shimmery and glittery at first, but then it turns out was actually all pink lights, pink LEDs on it, and then her dancers had also similar light up clothes and had light up, this is the rain imagery, had light up umbrellas that had LEDs along the outlines of it, so not the whole umbrella would light up, but the outline of the umbrella would. And then at the beginning of it, it started off with rain coming down, the dancers, male dancers, doing choreographed dances with the umbrellas and moving the umbrellas around, but with the lights down, so you would sort of only see the outline through the LED, but then you would see the rain effect on the projection was choreographed in such a way that it would, or the dancers were choreographed to match with the rain effect, and it would part around the umbrella, the light-up umbrellas as they would be moving around, and it was magical. Just looking at that, it was like to see that thing happening there was unlike anything that I had ever seen in a live setting, certainly, but even like in a film, that would be beautiful. Just thinking about, like, hey, how they animated it. Like, it would take an incredible amount of skill to do that just for a film. But the fact that they were doing that live was, and doing it repeatedly successfully every night, was mind boggling. And the music comes in and then they're choreographing along with the music. And How You Got the Girl is a great song. It's not a great song. It's a very good song. But it just was such a blast in that setting and then at the end of the last bit of the song, when all the lights go down and you're just seeing the LEDs on Taylor and on everyone else, and it's just these dancing silhouettes, and it's like, oh, this is so cool. It's just so interesting and unique and fun. It's fun. That was the big thing about this show. This show was a fun show. It was just a blast. And you know, it can be a fun show while still being incredibly emotionally moving. I don't cry very often. In general. And I don't cry at concerts very often either, but I do on occasion. I can't actually remember when was. I can remember the last time that I cried. I'm going to say, up until Saturday, I would not be able to remember the last time that I cried at a concert. My guess is probably at one of the two Gaslight Anthem shows I saw in the last, not calendar year, but last 12 months. And probably the one in Amsterdam that I saw by myself, just because I tend to be more likely to do it if I'm by myself, because there's that idea of, like, you can fully emotionally connect if you're by yourself, whereas if you're with other people, at least for me, with, yay, social anxiety, undiagnosed social anxiety, just for disclosure, it's not like a grain of salt with me saying that, but like, I'm pretty sure that is the case, whatever. But not trying to say that it's like an actual diagnosis or blah, blah. Anyway, unnecessary. But if you're with other people, then at least for me, there's always the part of me that's focusing on them, or focusing on what is their reaction to things, or focusing on, are they having a good time, blah, blah, blah. And it means that you cannot fully, completely connect, one-to-one with the music and with the art that is happening. I also went to the, I guess I should mention this, went to the Taylor Swift concert alone, which I do think, yes, it would have been a huge, they were just different experiences. It would have been a blast to go with people. But it, I think on, in the long term, I prefer that I went alone, to be honest, for something that ended up being so emotionally moving. Okay, three, and the whole lead up to this is to say, up until Saturday, I don't think I would have been able to remember exactly when was the last time I cried at a concert. I now can remember that very easily in that it was this Saturday, and it was twice. Yeah, although when I say twice, it was like several little bouts of tearing up within a song or a song sequence. That thing happened twice. Where I would start tearing up during... So she played a song called Never Grow Up, which... maybe it was just the moment, and maybe it was just that, but it might be one of the most beautifully simple country songs that I've ever heard. And it was a Taylor Swift song I'd never heard before. I think it's an older song. Apparently this was the debut for this tour, and she's only played it live a couple times anyway. But I'd never actually heard the song before, and it is just so beautifully simple and gorgeous and complex emotionally, while also being incredibly simple lyrically, but doing very fun little plays on that very simple setup, which I like a lot. When, like, one of the most moving lyrics that I've encountered in the last several years is in a song, which is also one of the most moving songs, from emotionally moving songs for me, and also again in the last couple of years, but there's one lyric in particular. It's the song Funny You Should Ask by a band called The Front Bottoms, and there's during the first chorus sets up the line, but I was young, I thought I didn't have to care about anyone, but I'm older now and know that I should. And it's like, okay, great, it's a cool line, I like it a lot. Then it switches to the next chorus, and during this whole thing, he's singing to the you, this girl, Chelsea, I think is her name. And then in the second chorus, it switches to being from her perspective, and what the line is, but you were young, you thought you didn't have to care about anyone, and you're older now and wish that you could. And it's a combination of just, like, that idea being really brutally, oh my god, you know, the realization that you're... have had a problem, and that it was a problem that you could have solved earlier, but at this point, it's, you know that it's something that you should do, but you know it's something that you're not able to do, and that you're locked into this self-destructive and unideal pattern. Just, like, that's a pretty brutal idea in and of itself, to know that, like, your life is stuck in a way that it will, like, you know that you are not on, there's a better path, and you know that you're not on it, and you won't be on it, is... like, if you actually stop and think about that, is really brutal to think about. So there's that, just that line in and of itself. But I think a huge part of why it's so emotionally moving to me is because what it does is it takes that, it violates the expectation, it takes that rule that was set up earlier and then twists it very slightly, but just enough to make me focus on that thing. And that's the same way that this Never Grow Up song does, is it sets up an expectation in the chorus and then repeats that a few times, and then will does like little slight changes in that chorus that just sort of magnify the gut punch in a way that it wouldn't if there hadn't been this expectation violation pattern going on. So yeah, Never Grow Up, man, it's a, maybe I'll find that song and do that for the end song. I don't know, maybe I won't even do an end song, because my end song would just be the entire 1989 tour set list. But so Never Grow Up, then it went to a monologue, and it was a beautiful monologue about, you know, the fans and how great it is that you guys are here, and like you need to, it was just, I don't even 100% remember what she said, to be totally honest, but it was beautiful. And then it went into Clean, which, so I've had an interesting, I guess, relationship with the album 1989, in that I first heard it when I was in France. It's beautiful. I love the album. More and more as time goes on, I had been getting into this pattern of love the first half of the album. The first six tracks are great. The first six tracks are great, for the most part. I don't love Welcome to New York, but like Blank Space, Style, Out of the Woods, All You Have to Do Is Stay, Shake It Off. Incredible little cadre of songs right there. So I'm one of like, and then everything after that would sort of fall by the wayside. Recently, I think I like Bad Blood now. And it took me, you know, this solid 8 months in order to like the song. And I think it was just through pure and simple being beaten down. I mean, it took me 6 months to really truly love Shake It Off. So I suppose that's fair, but I think it's beaten me down. I think the choice of it as single is not the best choice. There, All You Have to Do Is Stay is my favorite song on the album. New Romantics would have been a much better single, but just because it was chosen as a single and because the music video, for being a so-so music video but being a great thing that exists in the world, because of that, I think just the constant exposure has beaten me down to it, and it's like I kind of dig it. Also, like, it was fun in the concert, so, you know, cool. But no, the whole back half of the album kind of floated away from me, especially because I don't have the deluxe version, so I don't have the whole, like, and okay, I don't love this back half, but if I sit through it, then I'll get to Wonderland and New Romantics, which I think would help a lot, have helped a lot. It's much easier to just, like, even though there are songs in the back half that I like, it's a lot easier to just say, like, okay, I finished Shake It Off, we'll start from the beginning, or we'll listen to something else now. Because it was sort of like, there's nothing really on that same level. I know that it's downhill from here, essentially. I will have to say, my favorite songs during the concert, pretty much universally, were the ones that I'm not as big of a fan of on the album. There are ones from the back half of the album. So Clean, a song that is gorgeous and beautiful, made me weep. It was amazing during the show. Bad Blood was really fun. The other time that I cried was during Wildest Dreams. So yes, I admit that New Romantics would be a much better single than Wildest Dreams. But after seeing it in that concert, man, I think I've got a link to it, yo. It's gorgeous and it's beautiful, and it's just the sense of fatalism that is attached to that song in particular is that, like, hey, you know, all I want is just remember me, but remember me in the way that the nice way. Remember me as something good. And just that beautiful fatalism that totally also exists in New Romantics, but weirdly both more resigned. I don't know, it's hard to describe, but it's a beautiful song. How You Get the Girl, both because it's a fun little jaunt, but also, like I said, because the images were incredible. Okay, I Wish You Would was still fun. It's still meh, a mess song. I Know Places, which that was much more of a case of me remembering how great of a song it is, because it is a great song. Because I hadn't been listening to the back half. Clean and I Know Places were two casualties of that, like, and now we're going to Shake It Off, so we can stop. But they are great, and they've always been great, and they were great in concert. But yeah, I do think part of it does have to do with the organization of the set list. So songs like New Romantics, Blank Space, All You Had to Do Is Stay, were pretty early in the set. Blank Space was number 3, New Romantics was number 2, All You Had to Do Is Stay was number 8. And those, just in general, the earlier, I don't like it when my favorite songs are early, because if my favorite songs are early, that means I'm just not ready yet, because most of the time the opening band has not, it's either not someone that I know, and therefore I won't ever super get into it, or if they just, you know, they won't do their job, they don't really warm you up, especially if there's like a half an hour reset in between the two, then it takes you a handful of songs to get into it. And like, it wasn't until I Knew Your Trouble, which was number 4, that I really felt like, okay, and at that point Blank Space is already done, it's like, okay, I'm getting into this. And really wasn't until Clean broke down the water floodgates of tears. It wasn't a flood of tears, but because I'm not cool enough to openly bawl at Taylor Swift's concert. I'm not being ironic. I would think of myself as a cooler person if I had done that. That, like, the whole show started to, like, take a turn from that point of being something not just really, 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 really fun, or really, 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 really fun. Sixth Relay for Life. Not Relay for Life. Relay for Life is great, but I was saying Really for Life, as in the Carly Rae Jepsen song. Nope, I'm not going to side. I was going to sidebar about Carly Rae Jepsen and about how I am both in love with the fact that there's so many think pieces right now about how Carly Rae Jepsen is the most underrated pop artist of our time, because she is. And I love that they're all there, but I also hate the part of me that's like, okay, all of you are writing the same think piece. Ugh, come on, get over it. But then again, it's like, okay, but everyone's writing the same think piece that has the same opinions that I do, and I was like trying to push for the thing that I want to happen, namely for Carly Rae Jepsen to become Taylor Swift level monstrously successful, because is Taylor Swift level great. But I don't know Little Mix. Taylor Swift has been having guests come on with most of her shows, other musicians usually, and they'll usually play a song of theirs. She had Fifth Harmony, which is a girl group, come on the Friday night show, which I didn't go to. She had Little Mix, another girl group, come on during my show, the Saturday night one. And I don't know them. They were fine. Their song was fun. It was a jam. Cool. Whatever. The song's dumb, but whatever. That's fine. But yeah, it just was sort of like, okay, whatever. And she did have, which was very interesting, just jamming out and dancing, not doing any singing, not doing anything like that, but just dancing up a storm, but in a very fun, not choreographed way. And you could tell that, like, that added a little bit of, like, life and more, a different kind of life into the show. But had Julia Roberts and Joan Baez come on during Style, which was fun, because it was just Joan Baez just in mom jeans dancing it out on the runway to a Taylor Swift song, and it was like, oh, this is so much fun. They're just doing what we're doing out in the audience. And it was interesting. But I yeah, they didn't really do anything. I will have to say a big part of, I think, why I don't I loved all the songs, but I didn't love the songs that I tend to love on the album as much in the live setting as I did the other ones, is because they are pretty, not gonna say perfect, but very, very good already, and so they just sort of do them the same way. Like Blank Space, with the exception of a fun little bridge, is pretty much identical. Same with Style, same with Bad Blood. But it's the songs that aren't 100% at that level on the album that got fuller and bigger, and they felt like they had some room to grow. So a song like Wildest Dreams has space where it can go live, because it doesn't give it all on the album. Impressively, Shake It Off does as well. It makes sense to Shake It Off does, because Shake It Off is actually a really minimalist song, all things considered. So Shake It Off has room to grow. Out of the Woods has room to grow, because it doesn't go towards its full, like, arena rock belting potential. Not belting in terms of, like, belting layers, but, like, belting, and so I'm probably not using the term belting technically correctly, but the whole reverb and roar of a crowd pushes up songs like Out of the Woods, Wildest Dreams, Clean, I Know Places, in a way that it doesn't quite for Blank Space. Yeah. Or All You Have to Do Is Stay. I think there also is something about the tempo and the melody of songs like that, that, yeah, it doesn't, they don't have that sort of roar and sing-songiness that a song like Bad Blood does, that, or Out of the Woods do. There's a rhythm to those songs that is a crowd rhythm, and or Shake It Off has that crowd rhythm, whereas All You Have to Do Is Stay doesn't have, it's a little bit too all over the place, and again, it's my favorite song on the album, but it's a little too all over the place and complicated to really get the full effect of having a giant stadium of 50,000 people shouting it. Same with Blank Space. But whatever. Yeah, no, it's the simpler, chantier songs that worked really well live. Oh, speaking of simple and chanty and worked really well live. Oh my God. I am convinced. I think this is the single greatest musical thing Taylor Swift has ever done is the 1989 tour version of We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. Cause it is a full on rock jam. Taylor plays guitar on it, plays electric guitar on it, noodles around on the guitar at the beginning of it while she's just singing by herself. It's just, what's great about it is that when that song, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, is delivered in the red, very poppy, glitzy style. It never goes out of style. You can't, not that you can't take it seriously, but there is a temptation to not take it seriously, to have it, to sort of throw it off. Songs like that, songs like 22, to sort of toss them off as being like, they're fun. They're just fun little pop songs. When you do songs like I Knew You Were Trouble and We Are Never Getting Back Together, the way that they're done on the 1989 tour, you can tell that they are being performed with 100% sincerity, which is, they are kind of silly songs, especially We Are Never Getting Back Together is kind of a silly song, but it gets at a real feeling, a real legitimate feeling, but it's giving it the respect it deserves, or it's not, you know, again, that's a bit of a anti-poptimist sentiment to have, is to say that the very, very poppy way that it's done on Red is not to be taken seriously, because of course you can take it seriously like that. But I guess what I'm saying is that it removes the kind of people who wouldn't take the song seriously no longer can. They have to, because it's playing their own game. Because it's usually like the classic rock type that would be anti-Taylor Swift. And here she is playing their game at least as well as they can. And it's just great. Also, it's just, that song has so much vitriol in it. And it's great to hear that vitriol. Like, I think it's crystallized by, there's the difference between, and I think, you know, there is still vitriol even in the poppy version, but it's vitriol that's caged in a very, like, snarky way, which is okay. That's a very valid vector to take when being vitriolic toward the person. But this is just rage. And it's crystallized in the indie record that's much cooler than, you'll go and find your peace of mind with some indie record that's much cooler than mine, Lime, because on the Red version, it's very much, like, sneering and snarky and just sort of like, oh yeah, some indie record that's much cooler than mine. Great. It's vitriolic, but it's making fun of the person, totally deflating them, taking the wind out of their sails. The way she does it in concert is she shrieks it. She screams it. And it's full of power and fury. Performant power and fury, certain to be sure, but like, it's, and again, both of them are valid, but one of them, by being able to do both, neither one can be fully denied, which is great. I love it. It's, and also it's just fun. I like rock music. I like loud drums and crazy guitars, and I love pop punk. I love power pop. I love the sort of stuff that takes rock instrumentation and things like distorted guitars and loud drums and thundering drums and heavy bass and all of that, but still comes at it with a great melody and great pop songwriting structure. That's why I think I tend to like that more than classic rock, or at least nowadays. Like, yeah, power pop and pop punk more than classic rock is because it has that that great hookiness to it. Now, here's what you're doing, is you're doing a rock version of a incredibly hooky pop song, so it's going to have elements of that power pop, pop punk thing going for it. It's fun, man. It's fun. Oh my god. And I knew that they were going to do it because when she started the tour, I saw a Rolling Stone post that had a bootleg clip of it. So I knew it was coming, but oh my goodness gracious, it lived up to the hype, man. Which, as could be said for the whole show, is that, like, I knew it was going to be good, but it lived up to the hype, yo. Shout out to Katarina, who on Twitter told me that, yay, it'd be really great. I knew it was going to be great, but it was even better than I thought it was. And then he's like, I'm going to tell you it's really great, but it's going to be better than you think it is. And then, right, correct. That was a correct statement that you made to me on the Twitters. Also, apparently my sister has a Twitter, so that's fun. What other fun things can be discussed? So here, I can just go down the set list. just to tell you what things were played. I don't think I'm going to talk about it. So starting off with Welcome to New York, which, again, I don't love the song, but it's a good starter song. It allowed the show to open interestingly. And again, it's chanty, so it was better live than it is on the record, but I don't love Welcome to New York. I do like the It's a New Soundtrack, I Can Dance This Beat bit. I like that part, but whatever. New Romantics, which is a banger. It was great. Blank Space, in which Taylor did some vocal loop stuff, which was fun. She hit her mic stand against another mic stand, which made a clanging noise that was the beat that she looped to and then sang along to it and harmonized with herself. And it was a good time had by all. And said Catley. She also had Catley, the word Catley that she shouted in the loop, which was fun because Catley. I Knew You Were Trouble, which is also 1985 and very heavy and pounding drums and removes the jangly guitar. And it's good. I like it a lot. I Wish You Would is a song. How You Got the Girl. Talked about that one already. I Know Places. A lot of doors. There was a lot of doors for I Know Places. That was sort of the motif at play. Many wooden doors were danced through and danced around and rolled around, and there was even doors on the screen, and it's a song. All You Had to Do Is Stay was great, because it's a great song, but again, it does not have a chanty melody, and therefore was not as supremely elevated by this sort of setting. Then Little Mix came on, and it was did Black Magic, which is their song du jour. Then here we go, getting into the crying season. We got Never Grow Up. Also, during Never Grow Up, though, or while she was noodling before Never Grow Up, there was... So there's some fireworks that went off during Black Magic, and then while she was playing around, more fireworks went off, and they were right, and she turns around and shouts, "Fireworks!" I didn't... they were happening yesterday too. I don't know who's doing them, but they're great. You know, I always want more fireworks. And it was great because, again, Taylor Swift, she's a performer. And so a lot of it is, there's the implicit assumption that most of the stuff, especially the monologues, are either rehearsed or at the very least planned out. Now that being said, they are performed exceptionally well. They are performed as if they aren't, which is a mark of a great performer, is to be able to, the only reason that I would assume that they are performed is because I know that as a performer she probably, yeah, they fit so well that they are probably built into the set and rehearsed, and that's great. I have nothing against that, because especially for a show like this, that again, like we already had this discussion talking about artificiality and performativity, and that's okay. That's a very valid thing to have, especially in a show of this size. But at the same time, it's also kind of great to know that here's that one moment that you can point to that. It was a similar thing with like Julia Roberts and Joan Baez dancing, is like, you know, this wasn't rehearsed. You know that this is genuinely, and even if the things that are rehearsed are true, but you know that this, no matter what, is genuinely authentic to your experience and exclusively the experience at this one show. No, I don't. I'm not saying that like she doesn't believe the things that she's saying in other things. Of course, she probably does. Maybe she doesn't. I don't know. To say, of course. It's impossible to know. The one thing is that it is great to be able to point to like two or three things during the show that you can say, hey, that was unique and real and authentic. Again, these are all troublesome, problematic words. Saying things like real, saying things like authentic. You can have things that are like, you know, something that's real. A Shakespeare play gets at real emotions. And how does it do that? By making up a story through fiction. Like, fiction can be very real. Fiction can be very authentic. So just because something is performed or written or rehearsed does not mean it's not, you know, it's really real and really authentic. All of Taylor Swift's songs, you know, it was what are written and performed, all of Taylor Swift's songs. So this idea of authenticity and real being separate from something that is performed or, I don't know. It's a problematic thing to think about. I don't really know what's a good word to say instead, but I think I've explained the thoughts and the purpose and the blah, blah, blah well enough. So whatever. But we go into Never Grow Up, which again is gorgeous and beautiful. We go into Clean, which made me cry. We go into Love Story, which is also... here's a thing. You know what? This is actually a thing that I really like about Taylor Swift. There's a lot of them, but this is a thing that I really like. And that's... So you have the album 1989, and which a lot of people are sort of hailing as like it's a great departure and a great you see this a lot about Taylor Swift as character development as get, and there are some ways that are very, very clear lines, like from her first album, that are actually very offensive. Of course, they are lines that were co-written with another adult professional, so like I'm willing to give, and Taylor Swift was a teenager, so like I'm very willing to give Taylor the slack, even if she I would be less willing to give her slack if she hadn't like improved going on, but like I will cut someone a youthful indiscretion that was apparently signed off by lots of adults who should know better. I don't remember which song it's on, so that's why I'm not like specifically referencing that one line, but like if you are a fan of Taylor Swift, or if you're either a fan of Taylor Swift or a hater of Taylor Swift, well, if you're a hater of Taylor Swift, I don't know where you're listening to this, but if you're either one of those, you probably know which line it is, because either you've had to defend against it, or you've had to or accept it. You can also accept it as a thing that happened. Like, that's sort of what I'm doing. It's like, I'm accepting it's a thing that happened, I'm accepting it's a thing that was bad, and I'm also accepting that, like, a teenager, and again, like, I'm placing more of the blame with the adult who co-wrote the song with her, but whatever. And if you're someone who hates Taylor Swift, you probably use it as ammunition. I'm saying don't. There are, well, I'm sure there are reasons to not like Taylor Swift. The difference is, I have not found one that I have not been able to beat away at various points, even before 1989 came out. Oh, I got into a fun argument with someone who is, at that point was a friend of mine, and now is a very good friend of mine, about Taylor Swift when we were in France, basically just saying, all right, come at me, why don't you like Taylor Swift? And then I won, and I was very proud of it. But actually, a big part of this is actually ties in really well. A big part of the argument had to do with this song, Love Story. Now, where I'm getting at is this idea that 1989 is the big marked departure, and sonically certainly is true, which, hey, that's impressive of yourself, that like the fact that you're able to make perfect pop in one sphere and then completely change over your production and also have not just like perfect pop songs, but like they are produced like perfect pop songs, whatever. Anyway, not exactly related to the thread that I'm following right now. And I'm sure other people have written about that, so fine, whatever. But I think that all too often people are willing to dismiss the more the quote unquote juvenile simplicity of things like Love Story, especially now in the face of like, hey, 1989's out, so 1989 is the good music, and then all this other stuff is like, man, whatever. And what I love about it is like, she's still playing Love Story, she's still doing a monologue before Love Story, sort of explaining her thought process behind it, and in her monologue she does actually sort of say like, you know, I wrote this when I was a teenager, and I wrote it about falling in love, and you know what, I hadn't actually been in love yet at that point. But that's not meant to dismiss the song in any way. She doesn't say that to say, like, look at this dumb song I wrote. She's like, yeah, this was juvenile, but it was a genuine expression of a juvenile thing and a kind of beautiful juvenile thing. And she was like, yeah, we read about Romeo and Juliet in class, and I changed the ending. I made it happy because I wanted to. And I'm like, hey, that's okay. That's a perfectly fine thing. And the fact that this is thrown in, especially the fact that this is thrown in right before Style, which is sort of, I think in many ways, a big Style and Blank Space are sort of big culmination songs of this quote unquote more mature approach to love and relationships. Although in a different way, I think, again, to say that they're more mature is, well, A, probably potentially problematic, but then you also get the idea of like, okay, what is Blank Space? Blank Space is an incredibly tongue-in-cheek, vitriolic fuck you to the media that is portraying her in this way, which is fun, but also like, it's not mature, but who cares? It's great. Although also we can talk for days about the fact that Blank Space not only resonates as a vitriol, like, hey, fuck you for thinking I'm this way, and also an absolute brilliant call to arms of like, wait, I am this way. This is great. I love it. So like, you have people that love it for both reasons, and some people that can love it for both reasons simultaneously, that both because like, I want to be the Taylor Swift character, and also because fuck you for making this character of Taylor Swift. It's brilliant. Style, it takes, I guess, a different approach, but it's very much this like, hey, Style, actually, I mean, realistically, the song that it should be compared to is a song like Should Have Said No, which is a really brutal, like, you cheated on me, fuck you, burning the ground, all your fault, hate you, which, again, valid. That's an okay thing as well. And then Style takes this much more like, yep, this is what we're doing. All right, well, you know, this is what we're going to do. It's fun, at least, I think, but it hurts, but, like, you know, hey, here we are. Approach to romantic infidelity. But so you take this song that has a much more jaded, at the very least, but some could say mature, some could say jaded, view of romance, and then right before it you put the most saccharine, sappy, and quote-unquote juvenile love story, and that you can have both of them together and neither one of them invalidates the other. It's not a either or choice. It's, hey, you know what, it's fun sometimes, the silly youthful fantasy. Hey, you know what else is fun, a incredibly sexy song about how life can be gorgeous and tragic at the same time. It's great there that you can, that's what I think is most impressive, sort of getting at the same part of, it would be really impressive if Taylor Swift had just made an album like 1989. If this was like her first album, would be phenomenally impressive in and of itself. If Taylor had only ever made her earlier albums, that would be phenomenally impressive, because again, these are, you could like segment it at any different point. You could say that albums like Taylor Swift's self-titled album Fearless, Speak Now, are really, really great country pop. She made incredibly good pop country music, and that's impressive in and of itself, especially if you add the youth factor into it. Then you take an album like Red and you say, hey, this is a really interesting unique blend of pop elements and country elements. It's very of its moment, certainly, but like, hey, and again, we're for all of, for just like you are for earlier, you have really solid songs underneath and you're doing a very interesting stylistic play with them, whereas the other three, or earlier three, are very much in the country pop, pop country world. This is a blend of pop country and pop in sort of very dissonant, what should be dissonant ways, but that work really well together. And then you get to 1989, which is just a really good pop album, 80s pop album, but blended with some modern sensibilities. Interestingly, I made a note of the fact that the last or the second to last song before the show, the actual Taylor Swift concert, started after the, you've noticed I haven't talked about the opening acts, it was Shawn Mendes and Vance Joy, two supremely ignorable acoustic guitar musicians, whatever. They're not bad, but like, again, supremely ignorable. There's nothing of interest to say. And the fact that the person who sat behind me when I arrived at the stadium said, hey, you look like Shawn Mendes. And apparently that's a compliment. Well, yeah, it's a compliment. He's fine. Whatever. Oh my goodness gracious. I was going somewhere, wasn't I? Oh yes. Openers. The second to last song before the show was She Drives Me Crazy by the Fine Young Cannibals. And I was like, this is a fun song. And to listen to that, I was like, this is a jam of a song. I'm really into this. And I don't remember what the actual last song was, but like, for some reason I made a mental note of that. Like, oh yeah, She Drives Me Crazy. Great. Wouldn't have expected, like, why is this playing before a Taylor Swift concert? And then read recently, like a day or two ago, that was actually one of the first inspirations for the new sonic style on 1989 was She Drives Me Crazy by the Fine Young Cannibals, which is presumably why she played it, or had it playing. And it fits, because I was trying to think for a while, like, what is the sonic through line? Because there is something really unique about the production of this album. It's not like and, you know, it doesn't sound like a Katy Perry album. It doesn't sound like a Lady Gaga album. It doesn't sound like a Rihanna album. It doesn't sound like a Miley Cyrus album. It doesn't sound like a Carly Rae Jepsen album. It does sound like a new Carly Rae Jepsen album. But even then, there is still a difference. It's much softer edges on 1989 than it is on Emotion. Emotion is much more, like, in your face and, like, jagged about it, but whatever. Both turns the glamour, the hard-edged glamour, up to 11, and turns the batshit weirdness up to 11 in a way that 1989 doesn't. It takes a more even-keeled and wholehearted approach to it all. What was I gonna say? Words, probably. What were the words that I was going to be saying? Takes a nice, even-keeled approach. But yeah, so it doesn't sound like any of those other things, but it does sound a little bit like Fine Young Cannibals. So there you go, you've got a sonic through line a little bit. But that's what's impressive about Taylor Swift as an artist. Maybe this will be my grand conclusion, because we're getting close to an hour, is that you have this person that can play in both worlds and play in both worlds at their peak. Love Story is one of the best saccharine, sappy romance songs that's ever been written. And Style is, I would say, one of the best of this sort of, with a smile and with sunglasses, but beautifully jaded, cynical song ever written. And the fact that you can put those two together, and then also put Clean right before it, and that Clean is this, like, brutally beautiful sad song, and then Bad Blood right after Style, that's this big fuck you, let's fight about it, we are never going to get together, Wildest Dreams, Out of the Woods, Shake It Off. The fact that in this set list you have all of these kinds of songs that are all playing at their peak for the most part. Not all of them are the best in their game, but they all are playing at a really high level, and that there is this difference between them, and that they can all work, and that you can spread yourself out that thin. That you can spread yourself so far out, but without spreading yourself thin, is incredible. And it's a lot of talent. It's a lot of talent, and it's a lot of ability. And take everything else away from it, Taylor Swift is just disgustingly talented as a musician and as a person. And I guess that is probably about as good of a place to end it as anywhere. So thank you. You've been listening to the Profundity Podcast, and I just talked about Taylor Swift for nearly an hour. And I could probably talk for more, but I don't want to anymore, because I don't have good vocal control and have been vocal frying for a lot of it, so my throat is starting to be a little, like, don't keep talking that much. I'm also thirsty is the other part of it, / dehydrated. And it's been a long time. I also, you may have heard, I'm not sure, I got a phone call at some point during that, but it was on the other side of my room, so I'm not sure who that was calling me. That's probably not a good call on my part to have there be a phone call and not, like, go to at least check. The fact that I didn't pause this to go do that, but whatever. If they had called again, I would have checked, but they only called once. And 90% of the time when I get a call, it's the wrong number anyway, so, like, We'll see. And maybe they left a voicemail. I don't know. I'll find out in a minute or two, but thank you for listening. I was going to try a thing. I keep forgetting to do it every single week, but I was like, hey, let's make this like an actual thing. So I tried doing the joke hashtag thing a long time ago, many episodes ago, and it was like, this is dumb and not fun. But if you do want to have anything to say, I mean, you can always just tweet it at me and it's like, fine, that's whatever. But there is a hashtag I'll actually be watching. I don't make 100% promise that I will check it all the time, but if you do want, you can tweet at me, at Andrew the Whip, perfectly fine. Do that. All as well. Follow me as well, because I tweet about Taylor Swift a lot. You can read the tweets that I quote during the, actual show if you wanted to, if you go back a few days. But, you can use the hashtag profun, as in fun. I am very pro fun, as also is in the first six letters of the title of this podcast, and say things and I'll see them, but you can also tweet at me. That works too. I'm nowhere near at this point where like whatever. You talk about Taylor Swift. What's your favorite Taylor Swift song? Have you been to a Taylor Swift concert? What was it like? Yeah. That's a good question. Audience engagement, community building. That's what we're doing here, man. We're building a community of people that listen to my narcissistic rambles. All right, that's enough. I'm not doing that song because what Taylor Swift song do you pick? And that is all. So bonsoir, enjoy your day, evening. I was gonna say evening because it's evening for me, but enjoy the time period in which you are listening to this, and every time period thereafter, and listen to some Taylor Swift while you're at it. Adios.